these body cams are they may hurt employee morale and may be unsuited to the hot, dusty conditions in which Border Patrol agents often work. Your response?
Police in nearly every county in the southern border, from the Pacific Ocean to the Gulf of Mexico, are using body-worn cameras in the same conditions, the same hot, dusty climate. They're facing the same challenges, and there is no reason why Customs and Border Protection cannot address those same challenges, adopt the best practices. They have lots of local police examples to turn to. There's absolutely no reason why they can't adopt these cameras. As for their morale, these cameras are not about them. These cameras are about the community. These cameras are about protecting us and our families and making sure that what happened to Anastasio doesn't happen to anyone else. Unfortunately, it has. It's happened to 40 more people since he was killed. 40 more. We cannot allow this to continue. Body-worn cameras are not a panacea. They won't solve everything, but they are a critical step for accountability of this agency.
Andrea Guerrero, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll continue to follow this story. Co-chair of Southern Border Communities Coalition, Executive Director of Alliance San Diego. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a development director to lead our fundraising efforts, as well as an on-air graphics operator. And we're accepting applications for our internship program. For all of these jobs, find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burks, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, as well as Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio hosted by Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott. Today's guest is Tyler McGinnis, policy analyst at the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and we'll talk about our ever-increasing poverty rates in Oregon.
President Obama visits a federal prison. There's a call to federal prosecutors to lessen the use of mandatory minimums. There's bipartisan congressional support for reform. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear national leader Van Jones, who believes now is the time to end the mass incarceration industry in America. That's Prison Pipeline, November 9th at 6:30 p.m.
And the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changin'.
KBOO Community Radio currently has a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. A $100 new or increased donation will become $200 to support the important work of KBOO.
If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors up to $10,000. Consider becoming a monthly sustaining member. This can be set up easily and securely online. Over 70% of KBOO's income is from you, our listeners, who take action to become KBOO members.
Go to kboo.fm/support to have your donation matched today, or mail your donation to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214. Thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, a regional gathering of community-based media makers sharing space and skills to build solidarity on November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus. There will be skill shares, issue-based strategy sessions, regional breakouts and workshops, as well as movie screenings and a keynote presentation, editors of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio here in Portland, 90.7 FM in Hood River, 91.9 and in Corvallis, 104.3. Today is Monday, November 9th, and this is More Talk Radio. I am Cecil Prescott, and our numbers for those of you who would like to talk with us this morning are 503-231-8187. This morning, we are talking about the economy, more specifically about how the lack of economic development has impacted people across the state. 2007-2008, we entered into the Great Recession. Since that time, we have heard in more recent months of the economic recovery. Unfortunately, the rebound is leaving many, many Oregonians behind. This morning, we are privileged to talk with Tyler McInnes, who is a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. They've recently issued a few reports about the economy, hunger, and how it has impacted Oregonians across the board. Just told me that they also issue a report on earned income tax credit and how that is impacting our economy. So thank you, Tyler, for joining us.
Good morning, Cecil. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about first the organization, Oregon Center for Public Policy, and then we'll go more detail about your most recent report.
Sure. So the Oregon Center for Public Policy, for folks who don't know us, is a nonpartisan, nonprofit research organization. We advocate for policies that improve economic opportunity for all Oregonians, but particularly low and moderate income Oregonians. And so the way that we do that, it was we conduct research and we publish fact sheets, reports like the ones that you've been referencing in the intro here. And we publish all of our materials on our website, which is occpp.org. So I encourage listeners to visit us there.
Excellent. And as you said, your work focus on how the economy impact people across the board, but also in terms of low and moderate income people. And most recently, you've have a report that I think puts in black and white what many people are feeling, that the so-called rebound is leaving a lot of people behind.
That's right. So we published a series of fact sheets in the last month or so, and looking at poverty and hunger in Oregon. And what we found when we started looking at the numbers is, just like you said, despite about a half a decade now of economic recovery since the end of the Great Recession, we're seeing that Oregonians are more likely to live in poverty, and they're more likely to live in a household that struggles to put food on the table or to be what's called food insecure. And so in real numbers, we're seeing about 1 in 6 Oregonians living below the federal poverty threshold, which I should note is a fairly low standard for what it takes to truly make ends meet. And similarly, we're seeing about 1 in 6 Oregon households struggling to put food on the table.
Now, those are two troubling statistics. 1 in 6 in poverty and 1 in 6 struggling to put food on the table. Tell us a little bit, what do we mean by struggling to put food on the table?
Yeah, so the food insecurity measures, it's a survey of households, and they ask them a series of questions about their experience with food. And so some of the questions are exactly that. At any point in the last month, did you run out of money, weren't able to afford food, or did you have to go without a meal in order to stretch food to make ends meet? And so those measures of going without are what we would talk about as hunger. But households who are food insecure are households who are maybe having less variety in their meals. They're having to opt for cheaper food options that are less nutritious, the more severe form of hunger is then perhaps skipping meals, a parent skipping their meal so that their kid could eat dinner, those sorts of things. So fairly straightforward. We're talking about people who are really trying to stretch things to make ends meet.
So people who, towards the middle or the end of the month, they see that they need to live and struggling to have food on the table.
That's right. For a lot of families, it comes down to making those choices between groceries and perhaps keeping up with the electric bill or some of those really basic but really difficult decisions that working families are increasingly finding themselves in positions where they're having to make those choices.
And in terms of food insecurity, did your study reveal, is this more prevalent in one part of the state or is it across the board?
Well, the numbers that we were looking at were statewide numbers. Okay. So I can't speak to where specifically it may be more severe, but we do know that there are many rural communities in which poverty rates have been higher in recent years. So it would not be surprising to me to learn that many rural communities were struggling with some of these issues on a greater extent.
So let's turn a little bit and focus then on the poverty issue. You mentioned that 1 in 6 Oregonian, and perhaps you can tell us what's the federal standards in terms of defining what poverty is?
Sure. So as I mentioned, the federal poverty threshold, which is the official definition of whether or not someone lives in poverty. $850 to be considered below the federal poverty line. So that's a very low standard to be considered poor or not poor. We know families living just above that line are really struggling to get by as well.
And that's I want to think about in terms of hourly wage. About what is that? About $6 or so an hour? Roughly?
I don't have that. It would vary depending on how many hours the person was working.
Well, we're assuming it's the 2000 standard, just so people can get an idea when you talk about poverty, what that looks like in real dollars.
Right. I think sometimes the annual figure can be hard to think about, too. So another way of looking at it is a family of four would have to earn about $2,000 a month to be at around the federal poverty line in 2014. And we know here in Portland, $2,000 a month for a family of four, that's not a lot of money
That wouldn't pay rent.
$2,000 for a family of four, you're right, it wouldn't pay rent.
Right.
Unless
they
lived in like maybe a 700 square foot unit.
Exactly. So we're talking about a very low standard to be considered below the poverty line.
So if 1 in 6 Oregonians meet this very low standard in terms of poverty. What about the impact on children? How many children are living in poverty?
That's a good question. There, more than 1 in 5 children in Oregon lived in poverty in 2014. And that's a pretty sobering number when you consider what the research tells us about the impacts that poverty has on childhood development. We know that children who grow up in poverty, you know, they're growing up in a household where they don't have the economic means that they need to grow up happy and healthy. It really does have severe impacts on childhood development. And so the fact that more than 1 in 5 children, 21.1% of children in Oregon, are living below this federal poverty threshold is pretty staggering.
And it's really important for people to understand that even that's an approximate number. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not an exact number because there are people who fall off the grid who may have been out of their dwelling units at the time. So you don't know if somebody might have been evicted during a time of counting or what has happened, and you may have lost track of them. I've been running into families who are living in their vehicles and may have been so for a year, which means it's possible that somewhere they're not being counted or accounted for.
That's right. I mean, these numbers are based off of survey data, and oftentimes surveys aren't picking up folks who are falling into situations like that. That's true.
So in just mere numbers, I see in your study that the number of people living in poverty, the official federal standard, are more than the population in Portland.
That's right. If poverty were a city, it would be Oregon's largest city. Mm-hmm. In 2014, about 644,000 Oregonians lived below the federal poverty threshold.
That's bigger than the metro area.
Bigger than Portland. Mm-hmm. That's right. So it's pretty staggering. It's a very real problem. And again, we're talking about this measure of poverty that is too low to truly make ends meet.
And what about in terms of, so 1 in 6 Oregonians generally are living in poverty. Tell us something about communities of color. Do those mm-hmm. stats differ?
Yeah, for communities of color, generally, the numbers are much worse. I'll start with white Oregonians so you can have something to compare to. In 2014, white Oregonians, 13.9% of white Oregonians lived in poverty, compared to 38.3% of African American Oregonians, 33.2% of Pacific Islanders, 28.1% of Native Americans, and 26.4% of Latinos. Asian Oregonians, 16.3% of those folks lived in poverty, but that number wasn't statistically significant from the white poverty rate. But for most communities of color, it's very true that the poverty rates are far higher than white Oregonians.
And you also note in your fact sheet something called deep poverty. What is that?
So deep poverty is a measure of true privation. We're talking about folks at 50% of the federal poverty threshold. So earlier when I was talking about this threshold as being too low to really consider what it takes to make ends meet, we're talking about folks at half that line, 50% of that line. And in 2014, about 7.1% of Oregonians lived below this deep poverty line. And that's higher than we're living at that line during the Great Recession years. So we're seeing Oregonians are more likely to be living in these really dire situations than during the years of the Great Recession from 2007 to 2009.
So that brings to my mind, at least in terms of this so-called economic recovery, who's benefiting from it?
Well, that's the question, right? The we've seen that Oregon's economy, by many measures, has fared quite well in recent years. In fact, I think from the period beginning in 2001, only North Dakota has had a state economy that's outperformed Oregon's. So Oregon has an economy that, when you look at it by a number of measures, is doing quite well. But it's not the benefits of that growth is not being shared widely amongst working folks and all Oregonians. You know, we've seen we've seen a trend over the last 30 years or so of widening income inequality in Oregon, and we've published reports on this on our website, and folks can find those reports at www.occpp.org. But we see increasingly the benefits of economic growth are going to a small group at the top, and folks at the middle and at the bottom of the economic ladder are really being left out of this economic growth.
So the gap increases between those who are benefiting and the reality for low and middle income workers.
That's right. In fact, in just the period since the end of the economic downturn, since the end of the Great Recession, we've seen low wage workers and middle wage workers, their wages have actually eroded or declined when you account for inflation. But when you look at high-end wage earners, the top 20% of wage earners in Oregon, they've seen their wages slightly increase. So the folks at the top are getting a slight boost in their wages, where everyone else is seeing their wages either erode or decline.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. We're speaking with Tyler McInnes, policy analyst for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and we're talking about the economy and how it continues to impact Oregonians. The great recovery is not so great for many Oregonians. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. If you have a comment or question, please give us a call. And let's go to Camille. Good morning.
Good morning, Cecil. This is Camilo Marquez.
Hi.
Recently at Cuba Libre, you remember?
Yes, I do. It was great meeting you.
I've been a regular caller to this program in support of social justice. I'm also a contributor to KBOO and to OCPP. And I want to make a comment that hasn't yet been touched by your guest, which I'm sure you can address, and that is the connection between poverty, employment, and health. Clearly, health is an issue in employment. If you're not well, you can't work. But even worse than that is when you're not well and you're working and you lose your job, you probably will also be losing your insurance and you cannot get health care. And what is really most appalling is that even with the expansion of Medicaid and the exchange, people who are covered still cannot afford good health care. And what we have seen is that as before the expansion, still the highest contributor to bankruptcy is medical debt. And there are things that we can do about this. We can address this problem. I'm a member of Healthcare for All Oregon. I'm a member of the Healthcare Committee of Jobs and Justice. And we are trying to get a bill that will provide for the state healthcare that is covered for everyone, regardless of your employment, regardless of your citizenship, regardless of your healthcare status. But this is not going to happen without a massive movement, a lot of support, and a lot of money. And if it doesn't happen, things are just going to continue the way they are. And one final comment I'll make that shows how steep this challenge is that you know about MoDa. MoDa used to be the Rose Quarter. And with the Obamacare, essentially, insurance companies were bailed out by the government. They were not able to make money without raising their fees, their premiums, and that meant people were not able to afford them. Now, MoDa is the biggest insurance company in the state, and they're still having trouble. And just recently, the Oregonian came out and showed that OHSU, the hospital, which is a state hospital that is contributed to by taxpayer dollars, has loaned them some many millions of dollars. And that is the indication of the strength of the stakeholders who will oppose universal publicly funded health care. And we need people's support. We need people's contributions please go to hcao.org if this is something that inspires you to be involved. Thanks.
Hey, thanks so much. We were going to go into next steps, but we appreciate that, Camilo.
One thing to do also is to have people speak to folks where they are in terms of applying for this. So, like, if people are at the various centers where you apply for social services, whether it be heating or food stamps or whatever, somebody should be there to inform people and to let them know to support this and that this is in their best interest.
Could I make
Thank you, Celeste. Can I make a
quick comment? Yeah. I think Camille raises a really good point in that, you know, a lot of these issues, they're not siloed issues.
Oh,
you know,
that's
these,
so true.
These are things that that are very much interconnected. And, you know, the Affordable Care Act did a lot of great things. It did help expand coverage for a lot of folks. But we know, as Camille pointed out, that we have a lot of work left to do if we really want to make sure that we're making sure all folks have access to quality and affordable health care. And so I think that's a worthy point that Camille makes.
And also, one of the things that I'm a little concerned about is that people realize it's not going to be by a presidential decree or effort, and it may not be by a joint presidential and congressional effort, because the insurance companies have basically been the ones that are playing us. You know, we must remember that no president can sign this in without the full support of the people. It's us that's going to make a difference, you know, and we have to remember that.
I just like to make a final comment to what you just said, Celeste. I think we know the political situation is not going to allow a national universal health care.
That's right.
Health insurance policy, but it can happen in the states. And I want to see Oregon be the first state to have that accomplished, just as it was done in Canada in 1948 in Saskatchewan and spread across the country. We can do it here, but it's going to take a lot of work, a lot of community support, and certainly a lot of contribution.
Thank you so much, and don't give up the battle.
Never.
All right. We're speaking with Tyler McInnes of the Oregon Center for Public Policies. Our numbers are 503-231-8187. The topic this morning is the economy and how the recovery continues to leave so many behind. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I guess it was about 45 years ago, the Powell memo came out by a future Supreme Court justice, and he laid out the conservative think tank plan on how to beat down America's working class. I guess that's not so surprising, but Chris Hedges wrote a book called The Death of the Liberal Class, and that's what throws me off. I was wondering if your guest could comment on how did this happen that the Democratic Party essentially abandoned the working class, starting with Jimmy Carter and deregulation, and then especially under Clinton with the passage of NAFTA and normalizing trade with China and so on and so forth. How was it that the conservatives essentially co-opted the economic agenda of the Democratic Party so that we had, you know, we never had any good laws against capital flight? Like, Germany has very strict laws on companies that want to leave Germany. They have strict enforcement of labor laws, so if workers talk about unions, they can't be fired.
Well, Sean, right there, you've named two reasons why. And, you know, I think you're asking an excellent question. I'm certainly going to turn over to Tyler. But, you know, sometimes we forget that the political parties that we're seeing, especially like with the Democratic and Republican quote-unquote divide, they're not really divided. And we must remember that.
Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership
it takes my
breath away.
It proves it.
You know, I mean, I applaud the passage of gay marriage laws. I applaud, you know, the cultural issues that the Democratic Party has stood for years and years and years. But the entire economic agenda, which leads directly to mass incarceration and early deaths from health issues like your previous caller was talking about, the adoption of this conservative economic agenda is just breathtaking. I can't even wrap my head around it. So if your guests could comment about that, I'd really appreciate it. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for your call.
It sounds like Sean is well read in the history himself. I think he raises an important point that, you know, the policies that have been enacted that got us here today, it's not necessarily the policies of one party. It's been a bipartisan the result of policies from both parties that have gotten us to this position today. And frankly, it's going to take policies from both parties to get us out of it. You know, we look at the federal level and there's a lot of gridlock there. And so we do need a change in the national politics. But you know, here on the state level, there's a lot of things that we can be doing to hopefully reverse some of the trends that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about things like significantly increasing the minimum wage, making stronger investments in our education system. These are the kinds of things that states do have control over, and we can start looking at some of those policies here to try to stem the tide to some extent.
But you know, I think people should really be realistic sometimes in looking at our two-party system. And even sometimes when we have a third party and they're lagging in some critical areas, is that it's not necessarily just the politics that run this. It's the dollar bills and the corporations. And we have to remember, I almost want to say the corporate nations, you know, but those are the ones that are making some of the bigger policies and policy decisions. They have powerful lobbyists, and we have to offset that by doing the grassroots networking that's necessary to make that localized change, like you're saying, with states.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, I know that there's an organization, A Better Oregon, which is circulating mm-hmm. petitions right now to raise the corporate minimum mm-hmm. for corporation businesses who earn more than $25 million.
$25 million in Oregon sales.
Right, and need to pay more Oregon sales tax.
And I just lost my thought.
I'm sorry.
So what type of, in terms of looking at policy recommendations are you able to make, and are you working with specific groups or legislators to look at state policy?
Yeah, we work on a number of policies. I mean, the one of the big ones that's happening right now, I mentioned just a moment ago, is the effort to increase Oregon's minimum wage. There's an effort to do that in the upcoming short legislative session in February. I know there's two groups circulating petitions to try to get on the 2016 ballot for different minimum wage levels. I think folks across the state recognize that the time is now. We need to, you know, working people, and these numbers that we've been talking about today really bear it out, but working people really need a boost to get ahead. And so we need a significant increase in the minimum wage. You know, we're working on something called the basic health program in Oregon. Camille earlier was talking about the need to expand healthcare access. Basic health is an option under the Affordable Care Act that allows states to expand eligibility to folks up to 200% of the federal poverty line for their state Medicaid program. So we're looking at something like that would really help more Oregonians who are kind of in that gap where they're not covered under the Oregon Health Plan, but they're also struggling to afford healthcare coverage on the market. So we're looking at something that would help those folks get better and affordable access. And on the issue of corporate taxes that you raised earlier, you know, in the mid to late 1970s, corporations in Oregon paid somewhere around 18% of all income taxes paid to the state. So when you looked at all the personal income taxes and all the corporate income taxes, 18%, almost one in five, were corporate dollars. Today, it's about 6% of all the income taxes paid to the state are by corporations. So we know that corporations can be doing more to pay their fair share. And so I think when groups like A Better Oregon, you know, that's what they're looking at, is they're saying, you know, we have a revenue problem in Oregon. We need more money if we're going to make the strong investments in programs that we really need to be doing. And so looking at places where people could be chipping in more, you know, corporations are a logical first step.
And you're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. Our guest this morning is Tyler McInnes, Former hockey player, but right now working with OCPP. Let's go to our next caller.
Good morning, Eric.
Morning. How are you?
Just fine.
I'd like to introduce a little concept of a corporate creep. Back in 1998, Oregon Health Science University was starting to move towards a public corporation mode. And at the time, that was University of Oregon's medical school. Well, U of O told them to go away, basically. But then in the last couple of years, Portland State, Oregon State, and University of Oregon have moved towards that public corporation model, which is an express way of destroying the unions at all those institutions.
Well, I'm not an expert on the public corporation model by any means, but I will say that we published a paper Labor Day this year on the importance of unions in combating economic inequality. And, you know, what we found in that paper was that folks who join a union see a significant boost in their, this isn't surprising news, I'm sure, to any of your listeners, but, you know, they receive a significant boost in their wages. And in fact, non-unionized workers who work in a heavily unionized sector, you know, perhaps they work for a factory down the street that isn't unionized, but the other factory in town is. Those folks can expect to see some marginal benefits from having the presence of unions in their sector. So we know that unions are an incredibly important part of turning things around here and really reducing the gap, combating economic inequality. So I think, Eric, you know, you raised a good point about the importance of unions, and we certainly echo those sentiments.
Well, at OHSU, I was lead steward for 3 or 4 years, and I watched the creep of corporations come in there. I had to tell my CNAs at one point they had to demote to hospital aide or get laid off.
That's not good at all. Well, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
You know, one of the things, too, that's really important is we have to remember that women bear the brunt of poverty. And without a strong union, a lot of women have not been able to get wages, let alone equality in wages. I mean, we talked about that, I think it was last week, with household workers uniting and the current push for domestic and personal care workers to unite. And so as you mentioned earlier, we have to look at the different areas that converge to help us make a successful push with this.
Let's go to our next caller. Do we have another caller online? In the meantime, one of the proven programs at work is the Earned Income Tax Credits, which helps lots of people. Your organization has a study in terms of EITC in Oregon, and share something about that.
Sure, yeah. So we just released the study the other day. So the Earned Income Tax Credit is like, as you mentioned, Cecil, it's one of the more important anti-poverty programs that we have today. And essentially how it works is it allows working families and working folks who are eligible to recoup some of their earnings at the end of the year on their federal and state tax returns. So the study that we released shows that Oregon has the lowest participation rate in EITC of any state. So just 73% of eligible Oregonians are claiming the credit. And we estimate that eligible Oregonians are leaving about $124 million on the table from unclaimed EITC credits. So, you know,
what are some of the reasons for that?
It's not entirely clear. The census has just started pulling together this methodology and trying to identify these folks. Mm-hmm. They think that rural folks are less likely to claim it. Childless workers may not realize they're eligible and are less likely to claim it. Mm-hmm. Folks who aren't proficient in English may not have the information they need to claim the credit. Mm-hmm. There's a number of factors at play, and it's probably a combination of a lot of different things. Okay. But what we do know is that Oregon's leaving a lot of money on the table, and these are dollars that would really go a long way to help low-income and even some middle-income families get caught up on a car payment or better afford this month's groceries, real life family budget issues.
Pay for medical care.
Exactly.
Did you hear that, Camilla? One more thing to bring to the folks, and this is a plum. So with regard to that, we're finding that, again, information is a really important tool. And I'll get back to that after we take this call from Leah.
Good morning, Leah.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Well, thank you.
Okay, I have a response to the health plan issue and social services to low-income people in Oregon. I have a family member who works in one of the offices, and she's been there for about, she's going to retire from there shortly in a few years. So she's been there a while. What she's finding is that they are overwhelmed with people coming in. They have very little resources in terms of time and staff.
Mm-hmm.
The staff that's there is dysfunctional because they're so overwhelmed. They're traumatized by all the people and the stories. My family member has this issue, goes to therapy all the time. And one of the things that they're doing there, which I find a very alarming, is right now they're in a place where they're changing the computer system. So everything is done on computers, appointments, claims are filed, everything, health care, food stamps, case management, you name it. And they're going paperless. And what happens is they take in a case, they put it on the line, and they shred the paper. So I'm concerned about, this is a serious issue, because all it would take is a flick of the switch and it's all gone.
Right.
Everybody's done. So, and the issue of overwhelm, the reduced resources, this is a scary situation. So we have a number of things on the plate here to deal with, and this is going to take other people helping out. So I'm appreciative of the person. I'm very well aware of the organization he works for, and I download their stuff all the time. So
Leah,
anyway.
Is it possible for, I know you're giving us this secondhand, but is it possible for people to request a hard copy of their information?
Well, I think so. I would do that. I'm a case manager, and I always said keep copies, make copies.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't trust them. It's just not a smart thing. Things get lost and cases get misplaced. The Veterans Administration is experiencing this a lot. They haven't gone to the point of shredding paperwork, but nine times out of ten, somebody makes a claim and they'll come back and say, "Well, we don't have those files anymore." But they are there, and you demand a search, and guess what? They'll find them. But for our social services to be put online, and especially in view of the political climate we have right now,
yes,
all it would take is a flip of the switch. Everything would be gone, and you would have no recourse. So, I found my little Bitcoin file, and I thought, I think I better start paying attention to this. But yeah, it's also something I think it should be exposed in the news, in the media paper, and Pamplin and Street Roots might be a good place to go with something like that.
Oh, yeah, good. Well, you should give them a call.
Yeah, I might.
I just need to make sure that the person's confidentiality is maintained. But I think an investigation should happen. And yeah, I will.
Thank you.
If the person from the organization has any other information on that, it would be great to hear about that.
Hey, Tyler.
Thank you.
I'll just say that I think that you raise an important point. I think we can be doing a lot more to making sure that those interactions at state offices are better for people on either side. So for folks coming into state offices looking for a little bit of help. Making that application process easier. There's a lot we can be doing to streamline that process and have it be less burdensome on families and folks who are going into those offices. And also making sure that we're making smart investments in those offices so that, we do hear about, staff folks, experiencing, having traumatic experiences with being overwhelmed. And we see in the numbers that mm-hmm. more and more people are needing, they need SNAP benefits or trying to get on Oregon Health Plan. You know, so there's a lot of people who are in need. And so making sure that we're making smart investments and we're setting people up so that when they are going to those offices, they're able to access the benefits that they're entitled to.
You know, a good way to handle this, and the only reason I can come up with these ideas is because I kind of do something similar for my real job, for my paycheck, is have classes to teach people what to do. And you get a bigger bang for that. You can have some light meal and go into communities and ask them how many make these applications, get a account, have a class, and teach them how to do it and how to document it. Because basically, there's no other way you're going to get this information out. It's got to be a grassroots effort. And, you know, having been a grunt, meaning AmeriCorps, you know, I remember being literally in the trenches doing this. And also when I was in nursing, same thing. You know, you put on educational opportunities and empower people this way, because there's way too much nowadays to teach people and to catch them. And then we can't count on the systems we use, like we're hearing the information system, to record all that information.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio with Celeste Carey and myself, Cecil Prescott. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 is the OMO Variety Hour. A reading from the article, The Future of Climate Change is Widespread Civil War, and a look at the upcoming climate change conference in Paris at the end of this month. Also, a look at class politics and sexual assault, and an interview with Gary May about his book, Bending Towards Justice, the Voting Rights Act. Hey, thank you, KBOO listeners and members, for your support. If you are not a member, please note that currently we have a one-to-one match for all new and increasing members. If you become a member at this time or increase your donation over last year, your donation will be matched one-to-one by a group of generous donors and foundations. So go to kboo.fm and support to get your donation matched today. And while you're doing that, let me remind you that we are talking with Tyler McInnes of the Oregon Center for Public Policies about the economy and how a lot of people are being left behind in this recovery. Let's go to our next caller. Hey, Camille.
Hey.
Hi, I'm back again. I'm not just calling to let you know that I'm still listening, but to raise a point that not many people are aware of, but it really reflects how all of the different issues your callers are calling in about relate to one another.
Mm-hmm.
It may seem like we have a lot on our plate, but if we realize that they're so connected, it means that we really need to be motivated to work together on them. And that is the issue of the Friedrich case before the Supreme Court. People remember that name, the Friedrich case. What that case does is it takes the issue of right to work for public sector workers on a national basis. Now there's state laws, but it's going to go national. And if the Supreme Court makes this decision, that means that public sector unions won't have the ability to collect fees and union dues from their membership.
That's right.
And it's important to know that the public sector unions really are the strongest and best resource behind progressive movements and social justice movements. And we really have to not let this happen, and it means organizing around this issue to protest it. Remember Friedrich case.
You know, you're absolutely right, Camilla. And the other thing that people really need to remember is that it's unions that pushed through the effort for all Oregonians to get sick days.
Exactly. Thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
So as you, you know, the work could be somewhat distressing, hearing about these facts. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, it seems as if we're living literally out the novel A Tale of Two Cities. There's certainly a lot of people who are profiting, who are doing well. But it seems from what you tell us and from our experience that more and more people are being left behind. Could you suggest some other policies that a state government might look at to close the gap, or ways in which more people can benefit from a recovering economy?
Sure. So, I mean, we've touched on the minimum wage. We've touched on the need for increased revenue and corporations paying their fair share. Mm-hmm. Something else that we're looking at is the need to pass strong wage theft legislation.
Mm. Yes.
To ensure that folks are paid what they've worked for. And so for folks who may not know, wage theft is kind of this umbrella term, and it includes the many ways that some employers, not all, but some employers will not pay workers what they're due. And so that could be anything from paying below the minimum wage. It could be for tipped workers, not paying out tips correctly or at all. So there's a number of...
It could be being asked to work off the clock.
Being worked off the clock, that's a frequent one. So there's a number of ways in which people are... they have their wages stolen from them. And so we're looking to pass strong wage theft legislation in the next year or two. And there's a number of groups that are coming together to work on that and have been for a number of years now. And so we're hopeful about that one. I think that's something that would go a long way for low wage workers in particular.
And if you would have a question or comment, you have an opportunity before we have to vacate these premises by giving us a call at 503-231-8187 and share your thoughts with us and with Tyler. You mentioned earlier that the there's a short session of the legislature that's coming up. Tell us again, are there any specific legislations that you're aware of that will be pushed at during this short session?
So I haven't seen any. I'm not sure if any bills have been introduced yet, or if they are, I haven't seen any. But we do know that minimum wage is going to be a topic of conversation and potentially action this upcoming session. So I would think that's probably one of the premier issues of this upcoming session. We heard the governor make comments about it recently. So I think that's something that we might see action on. And frankly, the legislature is long overdue to act on minimum wage. The last time the legislature raised the wage was 1989. So we're hopeful that, we see this great need that low and middle income families are having. And we know raising the minimum wage would go a long way to helping those folks. And so we're hoping to see action in the legislature.
So tell me, when you present these facts and figures to legislators, they seem pretty clear. What are some of the reaction you get and the reason for a lack of more aggressive action to address these issues?
Well, their very constituents.
Well, there are a number of legislators who take our research and they use it in testimony or at public events. I think it was last week or the week prior, there was it on K2? There was a minimum wage public forum,
yes.
And Representative Nose in his opening remarks referenced one of our fact sheets that we had put together on the impacts of raising the minimum wage to $15. So we see legislators out there who are supportive of our work and use our figures regularly. One of the things that we strive for. I mean, our motto as an organization is because facts matter. Mm-hmm. And so we strive to ensure that everything we put out there is factual or it's triple checked. We want to make sure that the information we're putting out there is solid. And so, whether or not people want to take action with the information we put out there, that's their decision, but we ensure that the information we are putting out there is factual.
And I'm smiling, not because I don't believe that the information you put out is not factual, but I also know that, there's a tendency to be in denial of things, and there's also pseudoscience. I don't know, but I'm wondering if there are other groups maybe similar to you in terms of offer non-facts in terms of when these issues are confronted in this state.
There are other organizations out there that have different perhaps some would say different points of view. I'm not an expert on those organizations and their processes, and you know, we strive to, you know, put out the best research that we can, and we know that, you know, we can stand behind what we put out there. And so, you know, when we're talking to legislators, when we're in Salem and working with our friends and allies and coalitions, you know, we know that the information that we're putting out there is solid, and you know, that's our mission is to make sure that we're putting that information out there. That's the role we play. And so what other organizations are doing, I can't really speak to, but yeah.
Well, I just want to commend you on your work and your ability just to, you know, just the facts, you know.
That's, well, like I said, facts matter. And then that's as an organization, we believe. So that's our mission, is to make sure we're injecting those truths into the public conversation.
Before we close, I would be interested in you just sharing either personal or maybe even from your organizational view on what is it that motivates you? What is it that is, why do you do what you do? And how are you empowered or encouraged in this work, which I couldn't imagine could be frustrating at some point?
It certainly is frustrating at times. I mean, I guess for me, I came to this work, I grew up in a union household. My father was a tunnel worker in Boston. My mother worked in the last state-run hospital in Massachusetts, and then later switched careers to become a public school teacher. She's a high school science teacher. So came from a working class family, and, you know, growing up, you know, I saw the benefits of that the unions had on working families and having access to quality health care. My brother and I we had access to good public schools, and you know, so I've seen the benefits of what unions can provide working families, and so I became interested in working class, working family issues early on. One thing kind of led to another, made my way out here, but always was on was pursuing a career path in which I could be working on those issues that mattered to me. And I've been fortunate enough to find a place here in Oregon where I'm able to work on those issues.
Well, that's excellent in terms of being able to work on what you're passionate about.
It is, yes.
Yeah. You mentioned about, you know, growing up in a working class family, and it reminded me of similar, and I distinctly remember before my father was in the union and after, and just the benefits. It was like day and night, mm-hmm. night and day, mm-hmm. in terms of what unions offered. So, you know, certainly it's something that we should continue to strive for in making all people, working people, a part of the recovery.
Absolutely. I mean, we have some work ahead of us here in Oregon to make sure that the economic growth that we're seeing in the state is shared widely. But I think, you know, we have a lot of really great advocates and organizations working on these issues right now. And so, I'm hopeful that we'll affect some positive change in the coming years. We saw some great progress the last year with paid sick leave, banning the box. There's some really great stuff that happened in the last legislative session. So we're hopeful that we can build off of those wins and continue to make life a little bit better for working folks.
I appreciate you for sharing that, and just to remind us of the ability to make positive change. And as you noted, in the recent legislature sessions, there have been some strong actions and laws passed that benefit low income and middle income Oregonians.
Absolutely, we saw those wins that I just mentioned. There was a new tax credit created that merged some existing tax credits that'll help working families meet their child care costs. So there are a lot of wins in the last legislative session, and we're hopeful that we can continue to build off those.
Well, thank you so much, Tyler McInnes from OCPP.
OCPP.org, that's right.
.org. And that's how people can find you, right?
Absolutely. All of our materials, everything we publish is available from the beginning of our organization to the current day. So everything that we've ever published can be found at www.ocpp.org.
And it's good reading. Anyone can read it and understand it.
Exactly. We strive to make our materials very accessible. We publish short fact sheets, and we really want to get straight to the point and have our information be easily understood and easily used.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cecil.
You've been listening to More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. Our guest this morning has been Tyler McInnes of Oregon Center for Public Policy. We will see you next time.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for two positions. We are hiring a membership director. This is a part-time position, 32 hours per week, $15.11 per hour. We're also hiring a PM News and Public Affairs director. This is a salary full-time position paying $31,400 a year. The full job descriptions and instructions for applying can be found on our website on the homepage on the right-hand side under News from the BOO. That's at kboo.fm. On the homepage, right-hand side, under News from the BOO. Applications are due Friday, November 20th at 5 p.m.
Join Grassroot News as we celebrate the revolutionary music of Fight the Power, Welcome to the Terror Dome, Public Enemy, November 14th from 10 p.m. to midnight. We're going to focus on Public Enemy. Why? Because we should. So join me, let's fight the power as we chronicle and profile Public Enemy, November 14th from 10 to midnight.
Mm-hmm.